Okay, the next case we've gone on this morning is docket number 81318, Gonzales v. Campbell & Williams. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? All right, Mr. Ray, you can remove your mask as you come up.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark Ray. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Tom Gonzales. If I may reserve 5 minutes, I would like to do so.
Sure.
Can you speak up just a bit? It's the air conditioning. It's hard to hear you. Go ahead.
Yes. Is this loud enough?
Yes.
The law in Nevada is clear that the basis or rate of the fee and expenses for which the client will be responsible shall be communicated to the client, preferably in writing, before or within a reasonable time after commencing the representation. As an initial matter, we would not be here if this law had been complied with. The law further provides that a contingent fee agreement shall be in writing, signed by the client, and state the percentage to accrue to the lawyer in the event of a settlement. As an initial matter, we would not be here if this law had been complied with. That law, of course, is Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5C, with which all of us as attorneys in Nevada must comply, and all of us are very familiar.
Mr. Ray, the request was for a reasonable fee, right? It's the court that decided to utilize a percentage to determine what a reasonable fee would be. Why is that improper? Why is that improper?
Improper.
For the court to utilize it, because the attorney didn't say, hey, I have a contingency fee.
It is not improper for the court to determine a reasonable fee.
Using a percentage.
Well, in this case, there was no agreement between the client and the attorney whatsoever with regards to any fee arrangements.
Right.
So determining the percentage, in our view at least, Justice Stiglitz, is essentially enforcing an unwritten and unagreed to contingency fee agreement. So, in other words, if the reasonable fee is based on a percentage, essentially what we're saying is what was said in the brief that was filed by the respondents, in which they said we were involved in a high risk, high reward situation. So because we were in a high-risk, high-reward situation, we deserve the fee that we got. We deserve that because of the nature of what we were involved with, which was a contingency case. So essentially, what has happened here is that the respondent law firm has had the district court judge enforce the fee agreement of a contingency nature that they never entered into with their client. So.
Was the client there at the settlement conference?
Was the client there at the settlement conference?
I would assume the client's there and has to
talk
to the attorneys about exactly, at the end of the day, what they're walking away with.
Yes, the client was there. Mr. Tom Gonzales, my client, was at the settlement conference. Now, the respondents weren't there, but Mr. Gonzales was there. So he wouldn't have been speaking with the respondents at the settlement conference. That was handled, Justice Silver, by the lead counsel from Venice, California. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. I don't know if I answered your question sufficiently, but obviously I welcome any questions. That's why we're here, and I'm glad that we had oral argument. Had the duties of an attorney to a client been complied with, Mr. Gonzales would have had the opportunity to either negotiate or discuss with the respondents or with his other counsel the proposed arrangements for this fee and to determine whether those were acceptable or not. And the consequence of not doing that, well, let me just say this, and I'll refer you to something in the record, because I think it's telling in this case. I'm at Joint Appendix 140. I'm at the footnote at the bottom of Joint Appendix 140. So this is a reply brief that was filed in front of Judge Denton. And in the reply brief, the respondents were making a comment about what they called Mr. Gonzalez's desperate attempt to disclaim an attorney-client relationship with C&W, which I submit to you on the record is not in the record. There is nothing of Mr. Gonzalez attempting to disclaim an attorney-client relationship. Nevertheless, it goes on to say that Mr. Gonzalez cannot, on the one hand, assert that TAFS, that's the lead counsel, is obligated to pay C&W, which, again, Mr. Gonzalez did not say. It's not in the record. But then it says, on the other hand, quote, offered to pay the firm's bills at a rate he deems acceptable. And this remark, which is what it is disdainful towards my client, Mr. Gonzalez, as if Mr. Gonzalez doesn't have the right to pay a fee that he deems acceptable, as if Mr. Gonzalez is not in a position that every
well,
other client...
Well, he's indicating a lodestar method fee as opposed to a percentage of as a fee, right? He's looking to, he wants to calculate an hourly amount, not a fee based upon a percentage.
Correct. Mr. Gonzalez offered in the response to the motion to adjudicate, Judge Perigari, yes, he did offer to pay a lodestar amount, yes.
But there was a lot of discussion about the customary practices for local counsel on these types of cases, contemplating a percentage fee-based award.
There is indeed.
Okay. And you're just indicating that a contingency fee isn't appropriate here, and that a fee-based or a percentage-based fee is essentially a contingency fee that he didn't sign up for.
Yes, we are. We are saying that a contingency-based fee is inappropriate without having any communication with your client.
But it's not the client. I'm sorry. So. Trying to work it out. The court has discretion on how it's going to calculate the fees. Go ahead. So if there's a, if you're requesting reasonable fees and the court takes it upon itself to say, right, I'm going to exercise my discretion, I'm just going to do this as a percentage. That's not the client, that's not the attorney asking for a contingency fee. That's pushing that down to the attorney. The attorney says, I want quantum merit. Everybody agrees, probably entitled to some compensation for his services. If the court decides and supports that with the Brunzell factors, why isn't that okay?
Well, first of all, the reasonable fee that was being requested was a contingency fee. So the court is faced, and therefore, with the question as a matter of law, can I award a contingency fee in the guise of reasonable value of services where there has been no compliance with RPC 1.5? Our answer to that is no, you cannot, and we've cited the cases. This is not the first time.
Because there's no written agreement.
Well, because there's been no communication with the client at all, let alone a written agreement, Justice Perigari, yes. This is a case where the fundamental, as I said, preliminary principle is that the attorney communicates with the client about a fee. And so in the Section 18015, which is the attorney lien statute, it says the court can award a fee if the, grant a lien if the attorney states the amount of the lien and determines that the lien is enforceable, or the amount is enforceable. But it does not mean that the court can impose a contingency fee as was requested by the respondents, simply because that is the custom and practice. That is exactly what we are arguing against. To be absolutely clear about it, we believe notwithstanding whatever custom and practice may exist, that custom and practice does not determine the fee, especially when the custom and practice for contingency fees is to have a written fee agreement as required by law.
But also, you know, for the purposes of the lien in this quantum merit, there was no written agreement under 180152. Doesn't that contemplate circumstances where there's no written agreement?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. It does contemplate a circumstance in which there's no written agreement. So what we are saying is that if 180.15 says the reasonable value of the services must be determined by the court, and the plaintiff, by the way, the motion to adjudicate, in case you're not familiar with, I'll keep going. I'll answer the questions because I want to. This is right at the heart of it. Yes. Yeah. The problem here is that the motion to adjudicate the lien, which was given to Judge Denton, mentions dozens of times that the basis for the fee is a contingency. That's what the declarations are all about. This is a contingency fee. We want the contingency fee. Well, if you want a contingency fee, you have to come to Mr. Gonzalez, as any client you would have to do, and offer him at least the opportunity to pay a contingency fee, have some communication, let alone a written fee agreement, according to the law. Otherwise, what can happen here is if the respondents don't have to have written fee agreements with contingency clients, neither does anyone else in Nevada. The consequence of this is the respondents, having not even attempted to get a contingency fee agreement with their client, are saying we're entitled to the contingency fee that we wanted. And that's what the motion to adjudicate this lien was all about. So they talk about a high-risk, high-reward opportunity because that's what a contingency fee case is. It's not about, when you award that, the reasonable value of services. You're just enforcing an unwritten contingency fee agreement. So the reasonable value of services, determined by all the factors, includes custom and practice or established principles, but it does not mean that those principles override the requirement for any client who's paying a contingency fee to pay it. The difference we're talking about here, if you take 117 hours of what the respondents provided to Mr. Gonzalez as services and multiply it times a reasonable hourly rate, you come up with, let's say, $600 an hour. You come up with $70,000. The amount they want is $1.7 million more than that. And it's only because they were awarded the contingency fee that is their custom and practice to receive.
Well, and again, the court couched it in the terms of a reasonable fee. And you're saying essentially, at least what I'm hearing, is you're telling me that a percentage fee is equivalent to a contingency fee. And there's case law out there that says no. There's a Corey case out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that says the opposite. It's not necessarily a contingency fee.
Right. But it is. Under Nevada law, a fee contingent on the outcome of the case is a contingency fee by Nevada, by RPC 1.5. It is.
Well, and the argument below was a reasonable customary fee in this circumstance in this community is anywhere from 5 to 10% up to 18%. I think they had Dan Polsenberg so.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
That's where my struggle is.
Yes, well, I struggle for the opposite reason, respectfully. My struggle for the opposite reason is on behalf of people who are, at the end of their case, have settled their case with their lead counsel and an attorney who's never asked or suggested that the attorney was due a fee from the client, comes to the client and says, you owe me 10% of your recovery. I struggle with that.
Sure. We chewed into your rebuttal time. I'm going to give you 3 minutes, and I'm going to add 3 minutes to Mr. Bice's time.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Todd Bice on behalf of Campbell and Williams. It's nice to be back in front of the court in person for a long time. So, subject to the court's questions and directions, I intend to spend my allotted time addressing 3 points. The first is that under the principles of quantum merit, the district court properly determined that the reasonable value of Campbell and Williams' services included, under the law, a consideration of the plaintiff's overall recovery. Doing so does not constitute an improper or invalid contingency fee. There is no question that if a lawyer wants to have a contractual right to a contingency fee, they must have one in writing. That's not in dispute here. We're not seeking a contingency fee. The firm sought the reasonable value of its services and put forward the evidence to the court about what those valuations were. And as the district court noted, the evidence was unrebutted by Mr. Gonzalez or Mr. Gonzalez's counsel. Second point I'd like to address is the assertion that this client did not engage Campbell and Williams. Yes, he did, as the district court noted. In fact, that was discussed. There's specific evidence in the record that he did. And his declaration was very coy in essentially trying to dispute it, but not deny what his other counsel had already said in the declarations. And then finally, I will address, provided I have time, that the fact that the lien here was properly perfected. Because under the law, it was timely, and the firm specifically followed the statute and specified the amount. And the firm even did better than that here. Because once it was agreed of what the outside limit of the lien would be, the firm stipulated to the release of the remaining funds, just like a competent counsel should always do. So there's been no injury here or no harm to anyone from the manner in which this lien was handled. So let me turn first to the issue about this is not a contingency fee agreement. We understand that. We didn't claim one. We're not entitled to a contingency fee. But under the law, the firm was entitled to the reasonable value of its services. And that's what Judge Denton had to address. Now, Mr. Gonzalez has spent considerable time attacking the firm, accusing it of all sorts of ethical improprieties in his briefs and ethical lapses, attacking them and criticizing them for the very successful and substantial outcome he had. The rule that Mr. Gonzalez would ask this court to create is not the law in this state, and it should not be the law in this state. Now, that's really what I want to focus this court's attention on, because he's seeking to establish a rule that will be mischievous beyond all imagination. As this court has previously recognized, and as most courts throughout the United States recognize, a party can always terminate their counsel at any point in time. In fact, even under contingency fee agreements, express ones that are in writing that comply with Rule 1.5, the day before a settlement, the client can terminate the lawyer if they want to, and the contract is no longer enforceable. That has been the law for longstanding, not just Nevada, it is everywhere. So what is the consequence of that? Well, the courts consistently say the lawyer has no contractual right to the contingency fee. He has no contractual right at any compensation. But what the lawyer has is a claim for quantum merit. And then the law, what does the law say? Mr. Gonzalez's approach would tell this court, well, since there's no valid contingency fee, the firm is now relegated to hours times rate, lodestar amount only. That cannot be the law, because this court would create high incentives for people to suddenly disavow their agreements because they could suddenly shift the risk of the litigation onto the lawyers. And it's not just those circumstances, Your Honor, where this comes up in real life for lawyers. Take circumstances where lawyers represent elderly litigants, nursing home victims, people that have been in a nursing home and have been harmed. The lawyer represents that client, has a contingency fee agreement with them, represents them, gets them a fantastic recovery, and guess what happens next? Relatives come out of the woodwork and saying, oh, you didn't realize grandma has had dementia for years. There is no contingency fee agreement. She lacked capacity. What's the lawyer's remedy there? According to Mr. Gonzalez, the lawyer is now relegated to, notwithstanding the substantial recovery that the lawyer obtained, according to Mr. Gonzalez's approach, Nevada law should be the lawyer is always relegated to the lodestar amount only, fees times or a rate times hours. And I could go on and on with circumstances where this comes up in the real world. Lawyers representing minor children who it is later claimed that the parent or whoever authorized the engagement somehow lacked capacity to do so. Under those circumstances, there would just We would be in an endless cycle of let's see if we can't get rid of the lawyers at the last minute and relegate them to an hour's times fees. And that's why I urge this court not to adopt the rule and to accept the rule that all other courts have applied, which is it is a factor that the trial court within its discretion has the absolute ability to consider. And here, what did Judge Denton observe? The only evidence that was before him on this issue about the reasonableness of the fees came from Campbell and Williams, Mr. Polzenberg, and Mr. Kemp. Mr. Gonzalez presented nothing to contradict that. One cannot argue or criticize the district court for accepting uncontroverted evidence on a point, and it certainly isn't an abuse of discretion, let alone a manifest one. The district court acted well within its discretion, considered all the factors, considered the and included considering the outcome. As courts have recognized, every fee can be characterized as a percentage. If I sue on a gambling debt for MGM on a case for a flat fee of $100,000 and I only recover two, one could say I earned a 50% contingency because it can be calculated, it can be characterized in that fashion. And if I recovered $1 million, well, then I only earned a 10% contingency. The point, and that's what the Fifth Circuit has observed. Every relationship, every engagement by a lawyer where the client recovers something, their fees can be divided into the recovery and characterized as a percentage. There's nothing improper about a district court doing that in determining what is the reasonable value of the services rendered. The client here got a fantastic outcome, and that was a factor that the trial court properly considered.
Well, the client, Mr. Bice,
yes.
The client did get a fantastic outcome, but to what extent is the local counsel, were their efforts instrumental in that, such that kind of going to this percentage basis,
sure,
as opposed to what Mr. Ray pointed out, a substantial difference between $600 an hour for the actual hours worked and then $1.7 million.
So, Justice Stiglitz, that's a fair question, and let me answer it this way. That is a factor, of course, that the trial court is in the best position to consider, obviously. So, but in this case, I will use the real world example. Mm-hmm. I would submit Mr. Ray has been Mr. Gonzalez's longtime personal counsel. I mean, the public record is littered with, and this isn't prison, littered with examples of Mr. Ray representing him. Mr. Ray is a Nevada lawyer. He could have represented this client as their local counsel if that's what they wanted. But this was a big money case involving issues of criminal liability, criminal wrongdoing that KPMG had engaged in. What better firm in the state of Nevada would one want to have if you're going up against a monster like KPMG on that kind of a case? There is a premier firm, and they hired that premier firm. And that's why this firm was involved in it. Judge Denton is in the best position to know. And if the argument is, well, this fee is excessive considering the outcome of the case, that's going to be within his discretion. And again, the record I submit supports the proposition that Judge Denton acted well within his discretion in determining that. If there was going to be a debate about what was their role relative to everyone else, Judge Denton would be in the position to know it. So let me turn, unless there are other questions from the court, let me turn to this issue about, again, the suggestion in the briefing that this is governed by the Lear matter, and that this was a circumstance where the out-of-state lawyers hired the local counsel and not the client. As Judge Denton's order makes clear, that is not remotely accurate. And in fact, Mr. Sorensen, the out-of-state lawyer, put in his declaration, which Judge Denton credited, that he had in fact consulted with Mr. Gonzalez, and Mr. Gonzalez, the client, had confirmed the engagement of Campbell and Williams. And in fact, again, Mr. Gonzalez's longtime personal counsel, Mr. Ray, was intimately involved. And there's multiple emails in the record where he is intimately involved with Campbell and Williams representing Mr. Gonzalez. This is not a case like Lear where, and remember, in that case in Lear, what happened was the local counsel actually conceded that the client had never engaged him, and that it was purely the out-of-state firm that had engaged him. And that was the only relationship. That's not here. And Judge Denton so found, and the record amply supports that finding. And then finally, the point I would make, because it's again raised in the briefs, is this simple question about the lien. right, the lien, they recorded the lien properly. NRS 18.015 specifies that an attorney has a lien, and if there is no agreement, which is what we have here, then that lien is for the reasonable value of services rendered. And that has to be determined by the court. Now, it's been suggested in their briefing that, well, you have to specify an amount in the lien. Well, this court rejected that in the Maynard decision, where it pointed out, particularly in a contingency fee type case, where there is no amount, that the lawyer is at a disadvantage, particularly lawyers that have to file liens. Because typically, if you have to file a lien, it's because you've either been discharged or the client, you know, you're at risk of losing it because the client may be trying to get out of paying a fee to you. So many times the lawyer actually isn't in a position to know what the underlying settlement is. They don't know the amount. They don't know how it's been structured. So what this court recognized in the Maynard decision was you have a lien, as the statute makes clear, you specify how that lien will be calculated, and that's what you do to perfect it. In that case, in the Maynard case, it was a contingency fee. But I submit to you, even in contingency fee cases where you have a fixed percentage that has been agreed to, and it's enforceable that it's been agreed to, even in those cases, there is always a debate about what is the maximum amount of the lien. Because you always end up in a debate about, well, is it pre-cost, post-cost? Does it have to take account of the fees of other attorneys that were in the case? Things like that. And what happens in those cases, just as what happened here, the parties get together, they come to an agreement on what's the maximum amount of the lien, and they enter into a stipulation to release everything else. That's what happened here. Campbell and Williams handled this situation appropriately. But because they don't have an agreement, and we acknowledge that there was no agreement, the statute says they have a lien for the reasonable value of the services they rendered, so they filed a lien conforming to the terms of the statute, and that lien, as Judge Denton says, was properly perfected and properly enforced. And the record, I think, establishes that. There has certainly been no abuse of discretion, let alone a manifest abuse. If the court doesn't have any further questions for me, I will.
Just to address the one issue on the amount of the lien, Mr. Ray is indicating it's improper not to indicate an amount.
I'm sorry, just
pardon. Mr. Ray is indicating that it's improper not to indicate an amount in the lien notice as opposed to just reasonable fee. Can you just address
that? Here's how I have to address that. Number one, we've got to remember, so first of all, the Nevada legislature has specified that when a lawyer does not have an agreement, i.e. there's been no agreement on the amount, they are still entitled to a lien. So the legislature has already contemplated this situation where you will not be able to state an amount because the court has to determine what the reasonable value are. And this court has emphasized under the Brunzell factors, as just an example, there is no fixed formula. So unlike a contingency fee case where you actually can identify a formula, under quantum merit principles for reasonable value of attorney's fees for the services rendered, there is no fixed formula. The district court has to consider all of the factors, has to consider all of the evidence, has to apply its experience and knowledge in determining what that reasonable value is. So in this case, just like in the Maynard case where this court held that Mr. Maynard's failure to state an amount did not disqualify the lien, he instead put in the lien the percentages that would have attached and that would have applied to determine the amount of the fee at the time of the fee's adjudication. Same principle must apply here. Because the statute says that lawyers are entitled to a lien even if they don't have an agreement as to the amount, they are entitled to a lien as to the reasonable value of their services. They file a lien specifying that, and the district court adjudicates it. And that's one of the reasons why the adjudication process on the lien is supposed to be quick, is because it then avoids any controversy about whether or not the lien is excessive or the lien is holding up amounts that are not in dispute. Here, Cameron Williams solved that by coming to an agreement with the other side of, this is the maximum amount that we will claim under the lien. Everything else is released. So with that, unless there are further questions, I hope I've answered your questions. It's good to see you all again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Ray?
Thank you. I know that you are aware that the attorney lien statute is a unique lien enforced by unique methods. That's what Justice Pickering said in Leventhal versus Black and Labello. And it's based on a contract, either expressed or implied. That's what it's based on. And that was in Gordon v. Stewart in 1958. I cited it to the court. What's important to understand why we object to the perfection of the lien is that when they applied for the lien, they did not state an amount, which is the reason why the statute was amended in 2013, or one of the two reasons. It was amended specifically to require an amount to be stated. This is a statute which you have said has to be strictly enforced. This is what their notice of lien said. Quote, the amount of the lien hereby asserted is the reasonable fee for C&W's services rendered in this action pursuant to Quantum Merowit in an amount to be determined by the court. So there is no question that the notice of lien did not state an amount and said expressly on its face that it was to be determined by the court. So to me, this means that what is being advocated here by the respondent is that no amount need be stated. An explanation is all that's required because of all the different circumstances that I'm not sure what those circumstances are, but that would go back to the pre-2013 days when the language said the lien notice must state the interest which the attorney has in any cause of action. So that's been rejected. Additionally, with regards to the Golightly case, and the argument in Lehrer. If Lehrer isn't the most closely factually similar case, I don't know what case is.
Well, Lehrer was an agreement between two firms.
Yes,
that's,
it was.
That's a distinction. It's an important distinction to me.
Well, the important distinction for me, respectfully, mm-hmm. would be that there was no agreement with the client in Lehrer and in my case. There is no agreement with the client. That's what I believe your decision in Lehrer was all about.
What it about not, the fact that you had Judge Denton getting on the one side emails that show that your client was CC, he's a sophisticated businessman, and
yes.
why can't that district court make the determination as well in this case that your client was well aware of the involvement?
Yes, there's no problem with that. I don't think that's an issue. Justice Silver, it's not an issue that my client knew there was a local counsel. C&W was that firm. He went to that office on the day of the motion for hearing. That's not an issue. They made that up. We didn't argue that.
What evidence did you put forth to rebut?
Well, my evidence is, there's a complete difference, respectfully, between saying, I know who the local counsel is, and I have an agreement to pay that local counsel a contingency fee of 10% so that my settlement is not the remaining 60%, the remaining 50%, or whatever the numbers may be. That's a very different thing. In all the cases that I know of involving the local counsel, well, that's not true. Some of the cases, the client didn't even know there was a local counsel. But in this case, the client did know there was a local counsel, but absolutely no communication about a fee. That's a big difference. There was also the argument about, in Lehrer, go back to yourself, Justice Peregrine, respectfully, on Lehrer. The argument that's being made here that through communications between the California Council and C&W, an agreement, arrangement, or understanding was reached is exactly the argument made by Justice Rose in dissent in the Lehrer case. Obviously, the majority did not agree with Justice Rose's argument in the dissent. So if that happens, that your attorney in California or another state, the lead counsel, becomes the agent of the client for the purpose of this, it defeats the exact purpose of what Lehrer was talking about, which is to have a direct communication and relationship with the client in order to obtain a lien. And that's why I think 1805 was rewritten. Thank you.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Just briefly, Mr. Ray, in his findings on page 8, paragraph 10, Judge Denton says that the evidence demonstrates that Mr. Gonzalez purposefully placed his claims in C&W's hands.
Yes.
What do we take away from that finding?
Well, you're talking about a deference to the discretion of the court on a mm-hmm. factual matter. although I believe it was included in the conclusions of law, but let's call it a conclusion, a factual conclusion. And what he's referring to is a question of law, though. It's the dissent in Lehrer. It's that argument that, notwithstanding the fact that there was no communication with the client, the attorney in L.A. acts as the agent of the client. And that's what he was using, because there was no other evidence in the case of any communication between the respondent and the client. So that's what my explanation is. That's where it's coming from, because that's the only place it can come from. And I understand that it has to be a clearly erroneous view of the law and so forth under discretion standard, but you can see clearly that what happened there was what Judge Denton did, as he said, in this case, C&W had many communications with the lead counsel, and since they were representing Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Gonzalez is being acted for in that instance. But the fact is the exact opposite. Mr. Gonzalez did not agree, or was not asked to agree at any time, to be the person who paid the local counsel anything. I hope that answered your question. Thank you for allowing us to have oral argument.
Okay, any other questions, Justice Silver? All right, counsel, we really appreciate the outstanding briefing in this case, and it's nice to have everybody back in person again. And we appreciate you being here today. This matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess.